Welcome to Worlds Apart. As one of the leaders of the Indian National Movement famously said, freedom is not given, it's taken, including the freedom to chart your own course as a people or as a nation. But in the world that's increasingly and deliberately segregated across political, economic, cultural lines, what's the price of such freedom? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Rasagan Maharaj, Chief Director of the Institute for Economic Research and Innovation at Tshwane University of Technology in South Africa. Professor, it's great to welcome you here in Russia, and thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you.
Thanks very much, and the opportunity to be here.
Now, I know that you were born in 1969 in the still apartheid-ruled South Africa, and I heard you say in another interview that you almost feel historically lucky to have been born, to have been brought into this world on the cusp of an outgoing era and at the dawn of a new one.
Yes.
Observing the latest developments in the world today, I wonder if you have the same feeling.
Yes. Well, we are seeing cycles in history repeating themselves. And a big concern of mine is, are we as a species learning from what we are experiencing? It's so important intergenerational learning is encouraged, because those lessons, in fact, hold our future.
Mm-hmm. And do you think we're learning?
I'm concerned about it. I'm extremely concerned about it.
But seriously, when people are talking and trying to make sense of what's happening around the world, some of them tend to fold into a sort of apocalyptic clan.
Yes.
Others tend to be overly optimistic.
Perfect.
I wonder where you place yourself and what would be, let's say, the one thing that worries you the most and that excites you the most about the current events.
Well, I think for us to have a more realistic, a material optimism, we really have to explore the depths of the pessimism.
Mm-hmm.
We really have to be absolutely convinced that we don't want to return to a past that was barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
And if we agreed to that, the future holds many possibilities. So my optimism is based on my pessimism.
Mm-hmm. I know that you, for quite some time, have been very critical of the economic system in the world, of the neoliberal system, which some could argue is also a system of privilege, pretty much like apartheid.
Yes.
To fighting which you gave many, many years of your life. And many of the people who have a stake in that system today argue that it needs to be reformed.
Absolutely.
Do you trust their intention to reform it in a more balanced, fairer way?
Yes.
Or do you think they will try to sort of shape the process in a way that keeps serving them?
Yes. So I think what history has also taught us is hegemony tends to reproduce itself. And the ruling ideas, because of that, have a tendency of placing themselves upon people. They bind people's rationality and then lock people into choices. So if you don't mind, I would encourage, rather than reforming neoliberal, we need to transform it.
Mm-hmm.
We need to actually embrace the fact that our challenges are bigger than what we've learned from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And for the future that allows us to survive on the planet, we need a new system.
Mm-hmm.
All the evidence shows us. And it's most acutely brought home by vaccine apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
So while we thought we defeated apartheid in 1994, to have seen what happened in the last 2 years, an entire continent was excluded from producing a vaccine on the basis that they did not hold intellectual property rights.
Now, in addition to COVID, we also now have the war in Ukraine, which at least here in Russia is seen as a much broader conflict than just the territory where it's taking place. And both of these calamities, in a way, are changing the system, because the COVID pandemic already rearranged the way global system, economic system was functioning. The war in Ukraine and the economic sanctions and counter sanctions are delivering even bigger shocks to that system. How do you think the world will be able to absorb it, and what kind of a world will we have after it?
So I think it's very important, as you raised, those two issues are big issues for us. But we have to understand it in a third issue that's even bigger than those two, which is the crisis of the climate and the ecology that we are inside it. Yeah? The resilience that we all need to be able to sustain ourselves in that, demands an equitable sharing of especially knowledge, resources, and the tools to cope with what's happening outside. Currently, if we accept the way in which the world is ordered, that is not something that's going to be delivered. It has to be, as you said initially, taken. It has to be something deliberately acted upon so that people build such resilient system and resolve crises. Most of what we experience today are the result of centuries of conflicts, but these contradictions come from a singular system. And it's incredible to believe at this point in the 21st century that people are willing to see us enter a catastrophe rather than change the system that's driving us.
But sometimes catastrophes, I mean, look at what is happening right now. Sometimes catastrophes force the change on the system itself, because I don't know if you visited Davos for the last couple of years, but they've been talking about the need to, you know, for more ethical, you know, balanced distribution of wealth for, you know, decades on end. But it is only now that the system seems to be changing by itself, because people never had enough resolve to do it.
I understand, as you raise it, in terms of the tools that we have available to us. So if we all only had hammers, every solution has to be a nail. I think as a complex 8 billion people, we have the opportunity to think of alternative ideas to resolve challenges. And the barbarism that we see around the world being predicated, a lot of it originating in Davos itself, cannot be allowed to continue in that form. As you said, broken promises once, twice, but now after decades, what we see is real lives that are lost. Look at the excess mortality out of COVID. Look at the people's lives being lost in Russia and elsewhere. In Africa, this continues on a daily basis. I really think we should have matured as a species to transcend those tools. We have more than hammers available to us.
You mentioned the species, and I remember in one of your interviews, I think it was a couple of years ago, in the midst of the COVID pandemic, you said that we as a species were under threat.
Yes.
Not on a national level, but really on a global level. But nowadays, everybody seems to have forgotten about, not everybody, but many people seems to have forgotten about that threat. There is a threat of a war in Ukraine right now. How dangerous it is, in your view? Do you think we are still under threat as a species? Because in that conflict, it's not only about the virus, but it's also about nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. Well, collectively, we are under threat, and the threats are escalating. A big part of it is the way in which also information and knowledge is being restricted and constrained. The imposition of certain restrictions on the flow of information really needs to be countered. It cannot be that a single narrative determines what's happening in the world. It's a collective enterprise. It's a social enterprise. The more exchange of ideas, the better for all of us. And we really need to encourage that type of dialogue to be increased.
Let's engage in that dialogue. And if I may, I would ask for your unreserved opinion, because you're here in Russia, but the war in Ukraine, this is what I want to ask you about, is a very difficult issue for this country, because on the one hand, it's the use of violence. It's enormous loss of resources and human lives, both on both sides. But on the other hand, I know that many people here see that as an ontological struggle, as a struggle for
ideas,
being who you are and being true to your own path, for the right to develop according to your own understanding of who you are as a nation. Now, I don't want to impose that on you. I would like to have your opinion as somebody who is equally removed from the Western perspective and critical of the Western perspective, but who can also be critical and objective to when it comes to Russia's interests.
Yes. So I think if we asked this question a century ago, which is just a few years ago, it would have been fine using the tools that we had and violence being expressed for self-determination, struggles for national liberation, etc. But where we are today, we are enjoined in a much tighter intradependency, not interdependency. It's so finely intimate. Personally, we have friends, we have family, we have people we work with in both territories.
And I have relatives in Ukraine who
that's
call
exactly
me
it.
Every night.
And we have to ask ourselves, in our families, when we have conflicts, do we have to resolve it violently? We really should be able to transcend that. But then the powers that be in terms of world systems are not in favor of peaceful resolution. And that's so important that we continue to raise that. Opportunities for peace have been broached. In fact, people have gotten closer to achieving it. But that doesn't serve the interest of those that are profiting from what's happening at
and
the moment.
And what needs to happen for all the sides? And we have here at least three sides, Russia, Ukraine, and the larger West. What needs to happen for all of them to have the motivation, to have a realization that finding some sort of a peaceful solution would suit them better than having this kinetic conflict?
Well, if you don't mind, if I use the link with the party that you had mentioned earlier. So for centuries, South Africa existed where people with black skins were considered subhuman. It was a belief expressed legally. And because of that, the position hierarchically was determined in that way. Today we would see, what a ridiculous idea. You scratch me, I bleed the same. To that extent, we've learned so much. And in that way of understanding, we need to push back against those interests that see profit over our lives itself. Reconciling ourselves is possible, but it needs to be people to people. And we cannot achieve that unless we confront, you called it the West. I would suggest being more specific in targeting who it is we are talking about. Uh-huh. There are very particular transnational interests, most of them headquartered in countries, North America, Europe, and those are the ones that are fostering the conflicts that are taking place.
You mentioned apartheid, and I think this this distinction exists even among the so-called white people, because within the larger Western community, I know that we, the Russians or Eastern Europeans in general, have long been treated as some sort of barbarians, you know, not knowledgeable enough to absorb all the supposedly civilized Western values. And in your writing, you argue a lot for sort of integrating localized indigenous knowledge into all sorts of political, economic, cultural thinking, understanding tradition, not putting it on the pedestal, but trying to integrate it within ideological thinking and within the innovation. What is in the way of doing that? Because it seems so logical, you know, you don't have to be me, I don't have to be you. And yet there seems to be a very strong pressure to confine everybody to some sort of ideal that doesn't work.
Absolutely. So I think as you frame it in that way, the defense of the indefensible, because that's exactly what we are confronted with, needs to be confronted with the evidence itself. So when we saw initially conflict take place, there was a huge opening up in Europe. Refugees, welcome. Signs held up. At the same time as that's happening and trains are being welcomed in, people are dying in the Mediterranean trying to cross over from Africa. Black students that were in these areas were refused exit. How is it possible that we continue on this basis? It's not everyone that was thought to be Ukrainian was welcomed in Europe.
Professor, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Rasagan Maharaj, Chief Director of the Institute for Economic Research on Innovation at Tshwane University of Technology in South Africa. Professor Maharaj, before the break, we were talking about how unfair this world is.
Yes.
And one of the features of the current crisis is the fact that it's not only Russia and Ukraine and the West that are suffering, but many of the third countries that have absolutely nothing to do with this part of the world in the global south. And that's primarily because of the use of unilateral use of extraterritorial sanctions. And if you look at it from an economic or survival perspective, Russia is a large country. It's fairly self-sufficient. I think it can absorb the pain. But many of the developing countries on the other side of the world are pushed to the limit because of the galloping food and fuel crisis. Isn't that also a form of apartheid, economic apartheid, when you make the decision for somebody else on the other side of the globe that they can take that pain?
So I think as you frame it itself, it's so important to realize if the system were to be applied fairly, it would apply to all, including those that are imposing such sanctions.
Well, they are suffering too. I mean, the price of gallon of gas in the United States is increasing, but it's incomparable to the effects that it's having, let's say, on some people in Africa. The Americans can take it. It's painful, but
I was framing it more in terms of the impact. So where you have the deliberate use of violence to effect certain things, we can look at Palestine, look at anywhere else in the world, we do not see the same imposition of sanctions against those involved in the conflict itself. The consequences then are felt as collateral damage. But even for that collateral damage, we need to respond. Where is the cause of this? What is driving these things forward? And in that context, if we had everyone belonging to a singular multilateral body, an international court for justice, as an example, then the sanctions that flow from it should be based on the will of 8 billion people. Not the waving of flags at each other. Mm-hmm. So to that extent, if we want fair outcomes and an economic system of sanctions against aberrant behavior, it has to apply to everyone. Mm-hmm. It cannot be singular that certain countries have the opportunity to utilize it and others are just the victims of it. The point about Africa and the consequences of the conflicts taking place as well, this is follows centuries of marginalization. And to that extent, Africa itself needs to pick itself up. To that extent, Africa has to develop the type of resilience that you say Russia has currently. And there's a lot more that Africa itself must do internally to redress some of its, and not be as dependent as it remains to be in world systems.
But, you know, there are a couple of examples in Africa, Libya being one of them, and I'm not trying to defend the Gaddafi regime, but I was in that country for many years prior to that conflict, and it was relatively well off. Certainly there were fair criticisms of how it was managed, but it was one of the richest, and I would say, most generous countries on the continent, and look, it's all reduced to a big slave market. Do you think your continent, which has been a source of material wealth for a significant part of this world, do you think it would be allowed to chart its course and to stand on its own feet, to, you know, develop on its own?
As you raise it in that way, it's so important for us to realize what is the norm that's being aspired towards. If Africa continues to believe it is catching up with a Western mode, a variety of capitalism as it currently obtains, it has no hope because those ahead constantly put in place obstacles towards achieving that status. Africa really needs to reconcile itself to its people. 1.3 billion people live in such conditions that you mentioned. And we cannot afford more international intervention in Africa. It must be as Africans itself. Libya was a key sponsor of the African Union, besides South Africa contributing financially to it. And that's why in terms of now, we need to be really concerned that the agenda of the African Union becomes driven by donors and not by the subscribing members who are African themselves.
Now, let me broaden our discussion a little bit here because we are recording this conversation on the sidelines of the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, and it's become a tradition here to have some sort of a panel on the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as well as some observing members. And it's true that they have enormous human and economic potential, but compared to the consolidation and integration of the West, I think their synergies remain in a somewhat latent form, to put it diplomatically. What do you think prevents all those countries who have a lot to contribute to the international system from you know, using the organization better or more efficiently.
So I think as we understand BRICS, it's important for us to look beyond just the letters that comprise it. We are talking of nearly two-thirds of humankind being contained inside such agglomeration. And we need to ask ourselves the relationship between that number of people and the states that represent them. The point I want to make is clearly, there are internal contradictions within each of the five countries as they exist. Some countries have managed to manage those contradictions better than others. It has had then an external spillover because of that. Also, the actions, what is taking place in Brazil, what's currently happening in India, are things that should have the concern of all of humanity, but especially the BRICS. And maybe we aren't paying as much attention to exactly those internal contradictions. The potential exists, but it's people-to-people potential. And we need to exploit that more than just seeing it as state-centric and leaving it or parking it aside on that basis.
You know, one of the things that I hear here in Russia often is that for BRICS to become truly meaningful, it needs to develop not just mutual trade, but try to come up with a new socioeconomic system that would better integrate the best practices of the member states, especially when it comes to sort of limiting the excesses of capitalism and expanding the public goods field. Do you think that's an utopia?
Yeah. Well, utopias remain utopias until we base them in material realities. And what we have available to us are the conditions that demand such solutions. It's really a question of whether the countries themselves. So if we use, by example, China has been able to recognize some of these challenges and has absorbed it into its domestic agenda itself. We can learn from China to that extent. We have different systems, different cultures. Two other points are quite critical in this, and that's the narrative, the formation of the thought, the ontological aspect around BRICS itself. If we link it more to the non-aligned movement with respect to the Cold War and look at the period post that, there's even better opportunities that spring from it. A third aspect is actually decoloniality and decolonization. Our colonial mental structures remain prevalent, and we see it all around us. Two civilizational states are part of BRICS itself. We have so much to learn in terms of that epistemicide that has removed it from dominant thought. If we return to that, we have much better potentials, rethinking the world, our place in it. And in relation to that, a future aspiration which is more ecologically sustainable.
I know that you have this great passion for public goods, and I wonder how far down the socialism path you're willing to take it, because I read somewhere that as a kid you were an avid consumer of Marx and Lenin. Do you think those somewhat discredited thinkers can still offer anything for the state builders, not in that form that has been tried before, but perhaps in terms of ideas or in terms of values?
Yeah. So I think an enduring value, particularly of Lenin in this context, was the ability to translate ideas into praxis. Bound in the context and time in which those ideas arose, it was appropriate, and we saw a massive move forward in terms of the progress of humanity itself.
Well, but at a significant cost as well
to human lives. But that was over time.
Yeah.
And over time, systems, if they refuse the dynamicism that allows people's participation, as soon as that gets encroached upon and restricted, the possibilities of remaining creative, dynamic, and finding better futures gets constrained. So I think to that extent, it would be inappropriate to bring Lenin from 1917 into 2022 and say, is he appropriate? No, he's in a mausoleum. It's up to us, the ideas that we've drawn from it, to bring it into practice. I would not advocate a type of state-led system that existed previously, because what we have available to us today far outstrips what was available then. Our means of communication, our integration globally, that allows us to bring about change much more rapidly. Those were not tools that you printed out on a little leaflet and distributed and got support for. So having these opportunities, I think creatively, and especially in a younger generation, those 25 years and younger, the possibilities without isms is so important. And we shouldn't then constrain. If we are willing to say, as you say, maybe some hold the view in Russia that socialism is a failure. But there are many that hold a view that capitalism is a failure.
I know from my personal experience in South Africa that there are many people who share leftist ideas.
Absolutely.
Where do you think the country will move now after having this very hard experience with COVID, at least in terms of the public health care?
Yes. So specifically, South Africa has proposed putting in place a national health insurance system. It's a concern for us. It isn't the full solution. What we need is good quality health care available to all. And the object use, and it's part of the reform agenda, not transform, is how to make the system fit into one that allows for private participation. But this process is opening up. And as we start implementing a national health insurance, which is already policy, we will start seeing the elements of a national health system emerge from it. And a national health system ultimately is about health, not about medicine. And that's also quite critically important. It's a different way of thinking. We remove the sources of ill health.
And so it's putting a human at the center of that system rather than the material interest.
Yes, and the profits that then arise from. Another aspect with South Africa was the question of philanthropy and whether we can expect private donations. Mm-hmm. And this is really what's troubled all of Africa with vaccines itself. As opposed to, we can talk about distribution and maldistribution, but if you don't produce something, what do you have to share? Mm-hmm. So to that extent, having productive capabilities remains important, mm-hmm. and even in health. We need to bring indigenous and traditional ways of thinking about health, mm-hmm. about well-being, back into such discussions itself.
And I guess that would apply not only for Africa or South Africa in particular, but for the rest of the world, because in each individual countries, we are dealing with pretty much the same challenges, but we are dealing with them in a different way.
Yes. And I think these are going to accelerate, really because of climate change and the rapid pace at which that's happening. If we as societies have evolved and emerged within particular geographic territories, we have come to understand how best to cope within those territories. That's the knowledges that have been excluded. And we now norm to, as you said, a North American model of health. The BRICS have discussed well-being. Reports were produced, but none of this, because it didn't have a narrow economic perspective, gained currency. So there are discussions such as that. And I was so impressed when I listened to Russia's presentation. I didn't think that they had such a wealth of indigenous knowledge in the Northern Territories, the Eastern Territories, that are incorporated in how we understand
health. It's ultimately about valuing your own experience, bad and good experience, and being able to analyze it, rather than looking at some distant star and believing that your only goal is to be like someone else.
Yeah, I think that's the crux of the matter, to be like someone else. No, there are 8 billion of us. Each one of us is an individual, but we coexist on a planet with other life forms. And to that extent, that's where indigenous knowledge is so important. Over millennia, we as a species have managed to cope with our environment in interaction with others. That's not the norm today.
Yeah, well, indigenous and global, ultimately, no, it's a paradox, but it's a paradox that can work.
Yes.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you for this very interesting discussion.
Thanks for the challenging questions as well.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.